I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. The book has already gotten good notices. It's called Curiosity, A Love Story. Its author, Joan Thomas, joins me now. Set in the seaside town of Lyme Regis, we meet Mary Anning, the fossil collector and paleontologist, and Henry de la Beche, the geologist. The book is described as a richly imagined and beautifully written tale of two very different people and how their paths cross. The book reflects on love, class, the role of women, and the gap between religion and science. Joan Thomas wrote Reading by Lightning, which won the 2009 Commonwealth Prize for Best First Book, among other prizes. She is a contributing book reviewer for the Globe and Mail and has also won a National Magazine Award. She's a consultant for writing and publishing with the Manitoba Arts Council. Her website for more is joanthomas.ca. She joins me from Toronto this day. The book is published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Joan Thomas. Good morning, Ms. Thomas.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. What's curiosity about?
It's about a time when a group of natural historians in the south of England were realizing that their whole view of the world had to be revised. It's about a working class girl, she's 12 years old when the story begins, who finds a 10-meter marine reptile and excavates it and launches herself into a career as a fossilist.
Now, these people are real, right?
Yes, almost all the characters. I think there are three that I invented for small parts, but the rest are all historically based.
Yeah, and so where does fact end, and where does the fiction start for you?
I tried initially to ensure that I followed the facts exactly as they were known and just filled in gaps where they weren't. But in the end, I did take some liberties, especially with time. For example, when Mary finds the first ichthyosaur, it's 12 years before that creature is identified, and this is kind of hard to sustain in writing a novel. And so I changed... I did compress events, and I also had to decide which of the characters would be important to Mary emotionally, because she had confided in someone that she was in love with one of the gentlemen that she worked with, but history doesn't know who that man was. And so I made up my mind as a novelist which character would work best for my novel, and so that is my sort of presumption about what happened between Mary Anning and these gentlemen.
And is there much known about her? I mean, I didn't know anything about her until I read the preparing for this.
Yeah.
So is there much literature on Mary?
Well, she didn't do any scientific writing herself, but there's a number of letters that she wrote in her business as a fossilist, and there are accounts of her in other people's journals. People were quite fascinated with this young woman who was working the shore and fraternizing with the upper classes and so on. And so there are some accounts in other people's journals of her. And she is suddenly sort of part of the zeitgeist, I think. There's a biography of her that's coming up, that just came out in January.
How did you first come across her?
In Reading by Lightning, I have a character who, in the 1940s in England, who goes to field school from university. And I just... Googled various digs in England and came across Lyme Regis, which is very, very rich in Jurassic era fossils. And so I chose that as a site, and then reading about Lyme Regis, I came across accounts of Mary Anning.
Did you ever go to Lyme Regis?
I did. We went three times, actually, when I was doing research, and it was fantastic. Very, very beautiful spot right on the English Channel. And actually, the last time I stayed in a rented flat that was exactly on the site of Mary Anning's house. So that was lovely. I sort of experienced the shore as she would have, the view and so on that she would have had.
This might sound like a silly question, but how different is the place now from before to today?
Well, it's, you know, one of those little English towns where the downtown is very compressed because the streets are laid out as they were in the early 19th century. But, of course, you know, they're paved now instead of cobbles, and there's traffic and so on. But I think you can see the architecture of the town and the layout quite clearly. This is John Fowle's town, as you probably realize, where the French Lieutenant's Woman was set, mm-hmm. And Persuasion as well. So it has a lot of literary antecedents. And I think in many ways it's quite similar to what it was. And The Shore, of course, is always in flux because there are a lot of landslides. The layers are very soft and they're being eroded, and so new caches of fossils open up all the time. But that's very much as it was in Mary Anning's time as well.
So you obviously, in reading and researching on Mary, have some sort of affinity for her. What was it that really drew you to her and want to set a book around her?
You know, I think the moment it was clinched for me was when I read that she chipped the ink sacs out of 200-million-year-old squid, the belemnite, which was a kind of squid. She chipped desiccated fossil ink and reconstituted it and made her own sepia for doing drawings of the fossils. And I was so blown away by that detail. It seemed to, you know, fuse practicality and the aesthetic of the whole work in a way that I found really interesting, and I think I was sold from that point on. But she's a very outspoken and almost audacious individual in her personality, and it was really a lot of fun to read about her and to do the writing.
Her story is relevant to people today, is it?
Well, I think so. I mean, I saw these people as being in much the same situation that we're in now, in that we're kind of required to revise our understanding of our place in nature and learn to look at the world differently as we're seeing, you know, the extinction of species and so on. And for them, too, there was this huge paradigm shift where they had to revise their notion of time and man being at the center of creation and the fact that all of the animals they were seeing, all of these fossils represented forms that they had no knowledge of. All of this was huge and very new in the early 19th century. This was about 40 years before On the Origin of Species came out.
And her place in society at the time, you reflect on that in the book, right?
Yeah.
And because she's a woman, that takes on greater meaning.
Well, yes. I think at that time, even if her father, for example, had been selling fossils to the gentleman, he probably wouldn't have had much recognition or been acknowledged. But the fact that she was a woman meant, in particular, that she was never mentioned at the Geological Society. Her finds were described by gentlemen. They never acknowledged her contribution at all. And it was really in the 1930s... a natural historian in Britain, William Lang, began to piece together exactly how many of the finds of the period were Mary's and sort of put the whole story together.
It also had to do with class, too, didn't it?
Absolutely. Her father was a carpenter, and, so they were artisan class, and certainly that was a huge factor.
I know, did I pronounce his name right, Henri de Labèche?
Yes.
He's of a different class, right?
Yes, he would be upper middle class at the time. His father was a military man and owned a plantation in Jamaica. So they'd kind of fallen on hard times because the plantation was struggling. But yes, he was a different social class, and so, you know, any relationship between them is impossible on the face of it.
The Henry's own, I guess, impact or import in geology and the sort is what? Is that quite significant as well?
Yes. It's kind of interesting because he was drawn to earth sciences through Mary Anning. He moved to Lyme Regis and got to know her. But geology was really at its infancy, and he ended up writing sort of a definitive textbook and was eventually knighted for his contribution to geology. And in Jamaica, the geology department at the University of Jamaica is named after Henri de Labèche.
And so Mary and Henry in the book, they develop some sort of relationship, is that right?
Yes.
And is that true? Is this presumption now in part of the book?
Yes, and there's anecdotal evidence that she was involved with someone, and she confided this story in a girl named Anna Maria Pinney, who wrote about it in her journal. But Anna Maria said, "I'm so shocked at this, I can't even bring myself to write down the name of the gentleman that Mary was involved with." And Mary sort of dates this. She said, you know, everything happened, everything fell apart in 1824. And so I was able to look at which gentlemen were part of her life at that time. And I didn't write this novel so much as a serious argument that she had an affair with de la Beche, as just it was the most appealing to me as a novelist. He was a really interesting character, quite a complicated guy, and I was just interested in exploring what might have happened if, in fact, this was the man that she loved.
Was Mary educated formally?
No, she, as in the novel, she just went to what they called it a Sunday school, but it really was a literacy program for the children of the Congregationalist Chapel. Her parents were dissenters, and they went to this small chapel, and so they had a teacher on Sunday mornings to teach the kids to read. And if you see her letters now, her spelling is sort of idiosyncratic, and she doesn't use punctuation and so on.
I'm assuming that you had to do a lot of research in the course of this book, sort of the researching geology, paleontology, and the sort. Is that something that you had to do seriously?
Yeah, I didn't have a background in science, and so I did. Read quite a bit before I first went to England, and then spent quite a bit of time in the museums, and it was fun. I have to say, it was really a lovely experience. What you see when you go to the Natural History Museum in London, for example, is the scientific papers that were written about Mary Anning's finds, she could never afford to buy, and so you can see her hand copied her copies of these papers, some of them as long as 30 pages, and she reproduced the diagrams very accurately. It's quite wonderful.
Now, your last book, Reading by Lightning, that was also set in the same time, right? 19th century England?
No, it was set in the 20th century. It was set in the 1930s and 40s. And partly in England, partly in Canada.
Yeah, but this time, 19th century England.
Yes.
It seems like a fascinating time for you, is it?
Well, I didn't really intend to set another book in the past, but I came across Mary Anning's story and I couldn't resist. So I didn't think of myself as a writer of historical fiction particularly, and I suspect that my third book will not be set in the past, but it'll be contemporary.
Do you reflect in the book about this gulf between science and religion?
I do. It's the two were sort of fused in people's minds at the time. William Buckland, who's a man of science that comes into the book, had just started a faculty at Oxford University that he first called undergroundology, which I found kind of interesting. But his whole goal was to try to find evidence of the biblical story of creation in all of his fieldwork. So it wasn't really empirical science as we know it.
If you go to Lyme Regis now, can you get, like, sort of curios and things like that, fossils?
You sure can. There are probably five or six stores that sell fossils, and there are a lot of people that conduct fossiling tours on the beach. So I have a tiny collection of ammonites and belemnites and so on that I've found when I was on those fossiling tours. And they're still turning up huge marine reptiles as well. The second time I was there, they had just found an ichthyosaur. It was probably about 10 or 15 meters long. They'd found it that year and were excavating it.
What do you admire most about Mary Anning?
I think I admire the fact that she, in spite of all the hardships she faced, she retained an interest in the science that she was doing. She continued to try to push it. She continued to try to find meaning behind what she was finding rather than simply selling these fossils to make a living. Charles Dickens wrote a lovely piece about her after she died, and he said it wasn't a science when Mary Anning began, but it was a science by the time she was finished with it.
That poem, "She Sells Seashells by the Seashore," that was about her, right?
Apparently, yeah. It's a tongue twister that was part of a longer poem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I asked you earlier about the sort of research that you did in the course of this book. Reading, does that play a huge part in your life as a writer?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I've been a pretty avid reader all my life and did a lot of reviewing for quite a while, too.
Does the reviewing help the writing process? Like, you read other people's work. Does that help the technical parts of it, perhaps?
Well, I think it does. People would, when I began to write fiction, they would say, "Well, aren't you worried that you'll be sort of thinking as a critic, and this will kind of have a dampening effect on your writing?" But I think that I'm a better editor of my own work. So line by line, I think it helped a lot. In terms of the overall ideas in the book, I did try to turn off the analytical part and ensure that the book was sort of organic and that I entered it more intuitively. So I think in some ways I turn my critical faculties off when I'm writing fiction.
And did you always want to be a writer?
I'd have to say yes. It took me quite a while to get around to writing a novel, but yeah, I think it was always there as an intention.
How long does a book like Curiosity take?
It took me the usual 3 or 4 years. I was doing some reading. While I was writing Reading by Lightning, I was doing some of the research for Curiosity, and then once I started writing, I think it was about 3 years.
And for the 3 years, three or four years that you're doing this book, is it writing every day?
It is pretty much. I was working half-time through most of it, but I worked afternoons, and so I just wrote every morning.
Yeah, and do you have to do that at a certain place? Like if you're out of town, say, can you write?
Well, I do feel as though I have to work at finding sort of a pool of quiet in my life, and so if I'm out of town and there's lots happening around me, I think I would struggle to get the concentration that I need.
And so I guess you do it at a certain place at home, maybe?
Well, yeah, I do it in a study. I don't think, you know, the surroundings don't matter as much as the fact that it's, I'm just not interrupted and that it's quiet and so on.
Do you use a word processor?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I can't imagine how people wrote before, because I'm just constantly revising, so.
And while you're writing a book like this, do you do reading, like sort of similar reading, like do you read other novels, perhaps?
Yeah, I do. I know some writers don't because they feel it intrudes, but I do. I continue to read all the time. And I did, you know, part of my research, besides the science and history and so on, was that I read Thomas Hardy because his novels were set actually a little bit before he was writing, and so they're set in the same part of Southwest England around the time that Mary Anning was alive. And so some of the dialect and so on that he uses, I invited myself to certain words and phrases that Thomas Hardy used from the period.
And are you working on a third book now, a third novel?
I have an idea and I have some notes, but I haven't actually started writing.
This just sounds like a fascinating book. As I said off the top, that it's already gotten good notices. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it, Joan.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. The website for more is joanthomas.ca. The book is called Curiosity, A Love Story. It's published by McClelland & Stewart. Its author, Joan Thomas, on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.